This is an ABC podcast.
This situation again highlights that we are not free from this virus. There are still people getting sick and we are still at risk. We cannot be careful enough.
Western Australia confirms 6 new cases of COVID-19 from a live export ship. And the mysterious visitor on the loose in a regional town in Victoria.
I've been on the Victoria Police Force for 18 years. I've never seen anything like this.
Leading Senior Constable, would you describe this man as an animal?
Possibly. He's of indeterminate species, but believed to be simian.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. While debate rages between the states about opening up borders, Western Australia has today recorded 6 new cases of COVID-19. The cases stem from a live export ship, which is docked in Fremantle. 6 crew members have tested positive and have been transferred to Perth hotels. The other 42 crew remain on board. The ship left the United Arab Emirates on the 7th of May and was granted permission to dock by the federal government on the 22nd. WA Premier Mark McGowan says the Port Authority was not aware of the health problems when a worker piloted the ship into port.
The Al Kuwait departed United Arab Emirates on the 7th of May with a total of 48 crew members on board. This morning, 7 crew members were tested for COVID-19. 6 have tested positive, all males, and are being moved off the ship to a Perth hotel for quarantine purposes. Straight away, I had thoughts of the cruise ship saga. I thought these kinds of situations were behind us. It goes to show that strong border controls are important as we continue to handle this worldwide health crisis. I'm advised the ship was granted permission to enter the Port of Fremantle by the federal government through the Commonwealth Department of Agriculture on the 20th of May. We want to get to a resolution as soon as possible so that the ship is in a position to leave the port. The Police Commissioner has reached out to the Australian Border Force Commissioner and the Federal Department of Agriculture to try and get an understanding as to why the ship was allowed to berth at our port.
Western Australian Premier Mark McGowan speaking a little earlier.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Young people living in regional and rural Australia will be disproportionately affected by economic effects of the coronavirus crisis. A new policy paper by the Centre for Social Impact found the consequence of the economic shutdowns on young people have been severe. More under 25s have lost their jobs than any other group, and many of the unemployment hotspots are in regional Australia. Researchers say they're concerned this could result in young adults becoming welfare dependent for their whole lives. Associate Professor Hernan Cuervo is the Deputy Director of the Youth Research Centre at the University of Melbourne, and that centre has been involved in a longitudinal study of young people in urban and regional Australia since 1991. Earlier, he told me the demand for limited jobs in the wake of the pandemic could see many young people from the country head to the city.
Well, what happened is you have the competition between the have and the have not, and you have intergenerational competition between very mature, experienced, skilled workers trying to reposition themselves in a labour market and young people coming out of studies trying to enter the labour market. If the 2008-2009 financial crisis has taught us is that those that burned the most of the burden of the crisis is the young people, because they're just leaving study and entering, transition into the labor market and making their first step. In the study that we run, the Youth Research Center, we have found that it takes probably around 10 years for a young person really to establish themselves in the labor market, in a job that is meaningful and in that is related to their study. Now, for those that didn't complete tertiary education, of course, there's some availability of work, but much of that work can be precarious, can be casual, can be temporal. Now, if you switch this aspect from urban areas where majority of this job availability appears, if you switch it to the bush or regional areas, now it becomes even more problematic for young people.
So how do you see this playing out then, given when you looked in 2008, that's how it played out? How do you see this? This is unprecedented, and everyone's sick of that word, but like, we've never seen anything like this before. So if I'm a young graduate coming out of university and I'm in Ballarat, what does my future look like?
Well, I don't want to sound bleak or I don't want to provide a bleak future or bleak outlook for young people. But I think it's going to be critical, the government stepping up. Now, the government, the federal government and the state governments have stepped up to the plate, but they cannot project this stepping up of this support only till September or only till we see or think that the virus has been under control, because the effect of unemployment are carry not just for a decade, but almost for a lifetime, you know. So I suggest that one of the first measures the government has to do is to continue the JobKeeper program for longer than its plan. Another possibility is trying to give some tax breaks for young people, for example, that are coming out of university or have debts or hex debts, for example. There could be a program to retrain young workers or to provide cadetships, apprenticeships, and so on, and stimulate the private sector through the public money. Finally, what I think could happen in regional and rural areas is a supporting infrastructure and try to what the Victorian government at least is trying, an infrastructure program that provides job to these regional and rural areas.
What does a global event like the coronavirus do to a younger person's idea of the world in terms of mental health or how they view the world? If we think of, I'm trying to think of my own life, say September 11, it wouldn't have had the same knock-on effect as that. Or if you look at the recession of the 90s, how does it switch your brain in terms of the things that you're looking for, be it security of employment, be it the way we think about traveling? How does it change the way our brains think?
Well, this is a very interesting question. It's hard to measure today when we are in the midst of the pandemic and the crisis to understand how young people are feeling and how they are seeing the future. But let's step backwards or back a little bit. We know from study, including my own study, that young people tend to see their life prospect worse than the life prospects of their parents. That is not just in Australia, but also in Europe, in the UK and in America. This generation of young people is the first generation since post-World War II that sees their life prospects worse than the previous generation. If this was the situation pre-coronavirus, pre this crisis of unemployment, it's not difficult to imagine that how they looked at the future is probably in the lens of scarce job, of restricted mobilities, of opportunities really decreasing that rather than increasing.
Why do young people see their lives at this point in time? I'm not talking about here in May 2020, but prior to that. Why would that generation see their lives as worse than their parents post-World War II? That just astounds me that that's the case.
Simply because the nexus between education and work has been broken. If you think about the parents' generation or even their grandparents' generation, with completing year 10, most likely you will get employment in a factory, in some kind of manufacturing jobs, and for rural people, even in agriculture. Now, we know that more and more people taking the bush, for example. We know more and more people are not continuing with the family farm. It's very hard to compete with big multinationals. There's a lot of volatility in the market and so on. So the transition from school to work or university to work takes much longer. They want to put your roots in the labor market, get that meaningful job and have a secure job that allows you to form a family, to have a future, to buy a house and so forth. So many of the transitions markers to adulthood, like gaining full-time employment, buying your first house and so forth, were much easier to access for the previous generation than to the current generation of young people. Hence their view and outlook of the future as more pessimistic than their parents' generation.
Young adults who left school in 2006,
Yes.
They must feel like a much maligned generation then, because often they're, I suppose, often people discuss them as a frivolous group of people, but in what you're describing, they're not frivolous feelings.
No, they don't have frivolous feelings. They don't seek instant gratification. If they move in the labor market, it's not because they want to move in the labor market too much from job to job. It's rather the nature of the labor market that makes them move from job to job. And this is a generation of young people that study longer than any previous generation of Australians, and for that matter, in the Western society, and one that invests very highly in the labor market, sometimes with very little return.
Associate Professor Hernan Cuervo, who's the Deputy Director of the Youth Research Centre at the University of Melbourne. Thanks a million for talking to Australia Wide.
ABC Australia Wide.
If you listen really, really hard to the wind that's blowing, you can hear the voices and there's a peace come over you.
On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. It can start to feel like no one is talking about anything other than COVID-19. The health risks, the panic buying, the business closures, the restrictions, it can all get a bit heavy. But in one regional Victorian town, attention has turned to something else, to a mystery that's taken over front page news in the local rag. As Danny Greenlay reports, it's all anyone is talking about.
It's a mystery the likes of which Hamilton locals have never seen before. One man has had this small town of less than 10,000 people on high alert for 6 weeks.
You expect this kind of thing in Melbourne, but not in country areas.
Yeah, look, it's got quite a bit of the community on edge at the moment.
He's an animal.
Leading Senior Constable Ian McNiven says police are equally baffled.
I've been on the Victoria Police Force for 18 years. I've never seen anything like this.
Leading Senior Constable, would you describe this man as an animal?
Possibly. He's of indeterminate species, but believed to be simian.
So the definition of simian is relating to or resembling monkeys or apes, which fits. The mystery man is wearing a gorilla suit.
I'm Hamo the gorilla.
He agreed to speak with us under strict conditions we conceal his identity. Our sit-down interview gave some insight into the thinking behind a unique individual.
I thought, if I put on a gorilla costume and run down the highway between 5 and 6 while essential workers are going home, that their first comment when they walk in the door won't be, we can't go away for Easter. It will be, I just saw a gorilla run down the street. And then that will hopefully set the tone for the whole weekend.
And so without explanation or fanfare, Hamo started running along a highway leading into the town, much to the delight of truckies and commuters.
They were real happy to see me and tooting and waving and smiling and things. And went over to the wife and said, yeah, people are really digging that. I'll just go again.
See, rural and regional towns have been affected by COVID-19 in a unique way. A trip to the supermarket would typically involve bumping into 12 people you know and stopping for a yarn. Suddenly, everyone was averting their gaze, possibly towards your shopping trolley, and they knew how much toilet paper your family needed.
Like you couldn't handshake or give someone a hug or stop and chat, and if you did stop and chat, you felt like you were breaking the law or doing something crazy. When I was going to the supermarket and everyone was panic buying and no one was smiling, including myself. Everyone was frowning and confused. So that's probably a major reason why I started running as Hamo.
Along with that community anxiety came the individual stories, like that of Phil Holmes.
Me personally, I mean, I've lost my job because of it. I was in sales and it's gone now because no one's advertising. So there's people affected.
And, of course, the business closures. Amy Baker owns the pet food shop and says she's one of very few businesses thriving in the main street.
Yeah, it's been really tough with the COVID, so even our neighbours, a lot of hospitality around us have taken a real blow.
There weren't many positive stories getting around Hamilton, until Hamo.
Just to get the focus away from, you know, the negative that's going on and the tough times and giving everyone that big laugh and a focus away just to be happy, which is what we're all wanting.
Every single person is so sort of, I guess, uplifted by it because it's just something different and gives someone something to talk about. And it's getting traction outside of Hamilton now.
People were just looking for that break away from everything that's going on. I'm pretty desperate for it. And that's when I realised I probably should go online a bit more and give Hamo an online presence.
Yes, Hamo the Gorilla has his own Facebook page. Within a week, he had more than 1,000 followers. It also meant people could reach out with requests. Hamo has become a bit of a positivity mascot, taking selfies with business owners and promoting the local shops he visits, in full get-up, of course. But his main business is running for smiles.
If you saw a gorilla running down the street, you can't not be happy, really. You can't not smile.
Even if you're one of those hard outer shell types, like leading senior constable McNiven.
I believe that the community should engage with this individual. He's believed to be quite furry and humorous. If you need your grump to be terminated in any time, engage with this individual and I think he can help you right out there. Puts a smile on everybody's face.
But no one is as buoyed by Hamo as the person on the receiving end of all those smiles. For the man behind the mask, Hamo has transformed this period of uncertainty in the best possible way.
Like, kids are pulling over now and families are going out. I hear them calling out along the river, "Hamo, where are you?" And last night I got pulled up by a family for some photos and, well, that's great. That same family's going around town trying to spot me. I think one thing would be good is I think every regional town going through this needs a Hamo. So if you're out there, put on a costume and go for a run.
Not that it's an easy gig, running in the same thick, unwashed gorilla suit for months on end.
It's like running in a sauna. Yeah, but it's good because I'm losing weight.
And as long as COVID restrictions drag on, so too will Hamo.
Hamo will keep running until things are somewhat normal. When pubs are open and you can have a drink and slow dance with a stranger, that's when I'll put the suit away.
When you can slow dance with a stranger, that's Hamo the Gorilla, ending that story from Danny Greenley.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
Bush kids, they've got the benefit of seeing a lot of things, you know, and understanding how the environment works. They know where their meat comes from.
On ABC Radio.
Global pandemics like the COVID-19 crisis are indeed once-in-a-lifetime events, but look far enough back through history and you'll see Australia's faced down a similar threat before. Here's Evan Morgan-Graham with the story of how one Victorian town fought a deadly disease more than 150 years ago.
Australia is still in the grips of the COVID-19 pandemic, but this isn't the first pandemic the nation has had to deal with. Cast your mind back 170 years to the southwest Victorian town of Ballarat, a blossoming gold mining settlement drawing immigrants from all over the world. In the 1850s, there was another deadly disease endemic to Europe and Asia, smallpox. There had been smallpox outbreaks decades earlier in the Australian colonies, which had ravaged the Aboriginal population, particularly in New South Wales. So, for a gold rush community in its infancy, Ballarat needed to prepare for smallpox to arrive again. Just like the cruise ship tourists of the COVID-19 era, in the 1850s, travellers arriving by sea didn't just bring their tents and pickaxes with them. The disease came too. Catherine Weston, Associate Professor of Public Health at the University of Wollongong, says 19th century quarantine measures were strict, with quarantine stations in Australia's biggest coastal cities.
I think if they came all the way from England or Europe, they'd know that there was smallpox on board and they wouldn't be allowed off the ship. The quarantine was quite strict.
This was the first line of defence that kept smallpox from spreading to inland communities like Ballarat. But Ballarat historian Dr. Nicola Cousin says word of how smallpox was wreaking havoc elsewhere in the world trickled into the town in the 1850s.
With so many people immigrating, you'd get news with every ship arriving. There'd be newspapers, letters and people arriving. So the word would travel very quickly. They were well connected.
Back then, Ballarat's vital health infrastructure was rudimentary at best. Many people were still living in tents, bunched together in close quarters. It was a situation where smallpox could spread like wildfire.
There wasn't a public hospital built until 1856. So prior to that, there were just small private hospitals that were in tents, like 12-bed tent hospitals. So it's fairly sort of more primitive conditions than what we're used to now.
Ballarat was vulnerable. But health officials did have a weapon to fight off smallpox, one their current counterparts are working hard to forge for today's COVID-19 fight, a vaccine. The origins of the smallpox vaccine are well known. In 1796, British doctor Edward Jenner decided to test the anecdotal theory that milkmaids didn't get smallpox because of their exposure to the similar ailment cowpox. Jenner proved that deliberately rubbing pus from a cowpox lesion into a small cut on the arm kept you safe from smallpox, and after that, the vaccine was spread throughout the world. But how did it get to Australia? According to Professor Weston, overcoming that tyranny of distance involved using orphans as human petri dishes, a creative, if highly unethical, solution.
They would have like a group of orphans, if you like, and they'd start with one or two with these lesions on their arms. And then when the lesions, you know, when they got the lesions, they'd take some of that material, scratch it onto some other kids. About 2 weeks later, they get a pussy lesion, and then they'd heal. And then they take some of that pussy stuff, scratch it onto another couple of kids. And by the end of the long voyage, they still had a few kids left who had these active lesions that then they could go and vaccinate other people with.
The community was skittish, with the fear of an outbreak a constantly thrumming threat in the back of the mind. Health officials had to spar with the local newspaper in Ballarat, The Star, most notably in 1858, following an incident where a young girl in the community fell ill. At first, it looked like smallpox. The health officials inspected the girl and decided, no, it was a very bad case of cowpox or some other pox. But the Star disagreed, calling it a dereliction of duty. It turned out the doctors were right, and a half-hearted apology was printed in the Star the next day.
But it was that precarious balance of who the public should trust, the doctors with the strong reputations or the comments the press were making. And I think in Ballarat, the doctors certainly were more trusted.
The speed with which the smallpox vaccine was discovered and spread around the world was made possible by the ethical liberties taken at the time and the innovation and influence of the health officials like those in Ballarat. The search for a COVID-19 vaccine and how quickly it can be made available will depend on clearing many more procedural hurdles.
Evan Morgan-Graham with that step back in time. Today, May 26th, is National Sari Day. The annual day has been held in Australia since 1998 as a way of remembering and commemorating the mistreatment of the country's Indigenous peoples, particularly those who forcibly were removed from their families and communities, the Stolen Generation. So what does Sari Day mean to young Indigenous Australians? Kelly Butterworth sat down with students from Mount Isa's Spinifex State College to find out.
Sari Day means to me just commemorating the national apology that Kevin Rudd did. Just, you know, apologising for all of the trauma that happened during the Stolen Generation from the early 1900s all the way up until the 1970s. So we're Kalkadoon, so coming from the Mount Isa region. My grandfather's mother was taken from here and she was put onto Palm Island, and that's the same with my dad's grandmother. She was taken from here as well and put on Palm Island. And so they just grew up and started their family over there. So, you know, like my grandfather, he tells us stories about growing up on the mission and all the things that he had to do to survive just during the segregated times.
For an Indigenous person, it's really hard to relate to someone there because a lot of them are non-Indigenous. Like, last year was the first time that our Indigenous Ministers of Affairs, that guy, is Indigenous. It took us that long to get there. So I feel like we need to have more representations of Indigenous people in Parliament. I'm tired of non-Indigenous people speaking for me. I want someone that's related to me, knows what I went through as an Indigenous person to talk.
Personally, Sari Day, to me, it's important because we're able to stay connected to our culture, and even through all the hardships and with our culture being taken from us, we were able to reclaim it and our identity as well through the apology and the act that people took to get us to where we are today.
Young Indigenous women from Mount Isa's Spinifex College chatting there to Kelly Butterworth. And that's Australia-wide for this Tuesday. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can always email australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.